Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Drive Nation Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
We're covering lots of ground with this episode of the podcast, all of it at high speed. This episode, it's really about Lamborghini, about its history, its older cars, its current models. I think also what lies in store for the brand as well. We'll get stuck into all of that stuff in a moment. First, though, we do want to cover off a couple of different areas. Some interesting stuff has been going on. Andrew's driven an important new hot hatch. But first of all, we're going to start off with something that's really right out of your wheelhouse, Andrew. Your opportunity to talk about VanWall.
VanWall. Yeah. Okay. So by the time you hear this, the news will have been announced that VanWall, or at least the chap called Ian Sanderson, who now owns the VanWall name, is going to produce 6 continuation cars, which will be toolroom copies of the cars that raced in Formula One in 1958. Now, if any of you, which I quite understand, are scratching your head and trying to remember what VanWall are and thinking sort of old 50s British racing car, it's actually an incredibly significant mark. Tony Van Der Vel wanted, like so many other people in history, to, as he put it, beat those bloody red cars. And so he started VanWall as a Formula One team in the mid-1950s and chipped away at it, and with the help of guys like Frank Costin and Colin Chapman, came up with his sort of ultimate design in 1957 and 1958. It won the British Grand Prix in 1957 with Stirling Moss and Tony Brooks driving, which was the first time World Championship Grand Prix had ever been won by a British car with British drivers. And then in 1958, it was actually kind of the car to have. When it lasted, it usually won. And with Stirling driving, it actually won the first ever Constructors' World Championship, which was kind of the goal all along. Now, you may wonder why, having done that, VanWall then promptly disappeared. And the reason for that is that, very sadly, at the final race of that season, which was the Moroccan Grand Prix, and the 62nd anniversary of which was on Monday of this week, he not only clinched the title, but very sadly, one of his drivers, Stuart Lewis Evans, had a terrible accident. Although he survived it initially, and they even got him back to England, 6 days later, he died of his injuries in a hospital in East Grinstead. And for Tony Van Der Vel, that was kind of the end of it. He completely lost interest in racing. It was, you know, it was the most bittersweet of victories for him, and being far more bitter than sweet. And although VanWall did do little bits in 1959 and 1960, and I think even in 61, Tony Van Der Vel wasn't involved. It was never, you know, significant again. And it disappeared from sight. And it's kind of popped up every so often since then. There was quite a big attempt in the mid-1990s to get Van Wall Racing. There was some talk about Formula One. I think Nigel Mansell might have been involved, but it didn't really come to anything. And then, actually, in the 2000s, I don't know if any of you heard of a company called Ronart, but that was a company which was started by a bloke called Arthur Wolstensholme, and he used to make these rather fun sort of space frame, old style roadsters. I drove one. It was actually a very well engineered thing. And he got together with Ian Sanderson and started to produce a thing called the, what was it, the Van Wall, I think it's called the Van Wall GPR V12, which would have been in the early mid 2000s. This had a Jaguar powered engine and it looked quite like an old Van Wall, but it had wings and lights and that sort of thing. So it was a slightly strange looking thing. I never actually drove one, but that was kind of the last that we heard of Van Wall. But obviously the bloke hung on to the name and is relaunching it. And I guess the significant thing to me is that the cars are being built by Hall & Hall, which if you know historic racing will know are, you know, they are the best in the business. And, you know, I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that these cars will be perfect. This is absolutely not an attempt to produce some sort of slightly sad replica of, you know, some 50s racing car. These will be Van Walls. It'd be great if somebody who pays, I think it's 1.75 million for each one, is actually, you know, gets out there and races them, because you just, you know, occasionally you see, you know, the odd original come out and do the odd demonstration, but you I don't think I've ever seen one actually race. So that would be, you know, that would be terribly cool. And the reason there are going to be six of them is that Van Wall won six Grand Prix in total. So that's that. I'm quite excited about it. I'm just kind of wondering whether for a bit of press they might not let someone have a quick go in one.
Do you have someone in mind? Cool.
Well, I don't know.
You're thinking of me, aren't you?
I am, actually. Yes, I thought, you know, the young lad out and have a go, why not?
No, I completely agree. Can you clarify something for me? And this has confused me for quite a while.
Go on.
Can you, in a nutshell, summarise which cars are allowed to race in historic motorsport and which ones are not? I think, you know, we talk about these continuations from time to time. And I think Lord March has said that continuations will not race at Goodwood, hasn't he? Or something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, the rules are, there's a thing, you know, well, I mean, ultimately, if you're a race organisation, you can have whoever you want. I mean, as long as it passed the cars, past scrutineering, you know, you can have, you know, absolutely, you know, run what you brung. So there are no hard and fast rules about that. However, if you want cars that are properly peered, then there's a thing called, the FIA have a thing called an Appendix K specification, which means that the car must be to its original specification. It does not mean that the car must be original. Okay? And that is the loophole through which, you know, everybody dives. And, you know, so many cars you see these days, which look like they were made in the 50s or 60s, were actually made last week. And, you know, all sorts, you know, Ferraris, GT40s, Cobra, I mean, Jaguars, just, you know, the lot. And the reason for it, obviously, is that, you know, the genuine original of these cars are now so valuable that their owners, you know, don't much fancy racing them, because, A, obviously, it costs a lot to repair them when they crash. But also, you know, the serious point is the one thing you can never put back is the history. So, you know, you will often find someone who has, for instance, there is a chap in Germany called Wolfgang Friedrichs, who is a very, very eminent figure within historic racing, and he has one of the original Project Astons, Project 212. He also has a 214, which he is the first to say is a replica. It's a, you know, it's a copy of the original 214, and he races that all over the place, because if that gets smashed to pieces, then, you know, you're not destroying history. So it's down to the individual race organizer, but as I say the point is the car, you know, if it's to race in an FIA event, it has to be to original specification. It does not have to be original. So these Van Walls would absolutely be eligible. Now, being eligible is one thing, getting an invite's another. And if Lord March or anybody else decides that he doesn't want cars that were made last week at his events, he doesn't have to have them. So as I said, just because you're eligible to race doesn't mean you necessarily get to race. That said, being practical, you know, if Lord March wants a Vamble on his grid, and if I was him, I definitely would. You know, because the cars are absolutely authentic, I would be thinking to myself, well, you know, would people rather see a car which looks like a Vamble, goes like a Vamble, and is in every way a Vamble, other than the fact it was built in 2020 rather than 1958? Would they rather that were on the grid and know that that's what it is, or would they rather not have anything at all? And for me, that's just a complete no-brainer.
Yeah. The thing is, it would be quite easy to take a sort of lofty view of it, a high and mighty view of it, and say, well, they're replicas, I only want original cars to be racing. But if you know, if we all took that view, there'd be very, very few of these fascinating old cars running around racetracks at full speed, and people would maybe even get hurt in them. So, you know, I think the way it is, actually, we're lucky enough to get to watch what look and sound and seem and feel like old racing cars going at it at 10 tenths. And I'd love that stuff, so...
And they are the same. Okay, they're not the same because they've probably got quite a lot more power, but, you know, you could put a more powerful engine in an original car. It wouldn't make any difference. And as you say, you know, you get everything. You know, the sight, the sound. It's like, you know, that 250 LM that our mate Chris Harris raced at Goodwood a few years back. I mean, he was completely open about that car not exactly being, you know, built in 1964. But, you know, you saw it, you heard it, you know, would you turn around and say, actually, well, no, that car shouldn't be on the grid? I mean, forget it to me.
Open is the key point, isn't it?
It's all about the honesty. It's all about, you know, as long as people say, yeah, absolutely, here is this car because in the Vamble's case, you know, there aren't any originals racing, or here is this car because, yeah, I've got the original back at home, but I really don't want to stick it in the wall, and I don't think actually you'd like me to stick it in the wall, so, you know, here's one we made earlier. I'm completely fine with it. It doesn't give me any trouble at all. And more to the point, I don't think the spectators care. You know, I mean, forget you and me. You know, think of the, you know, the 135,000 people who'll go to, you know, Goodwood for a revival weekend. Do they really care? I suppose some of them will. So, I mean, there is a bit where you're sitting there and you're thinking, gosh, you know, that's the car that, you know, that Jackie Stewart or Ines Ireland or Jim Clark raced. And, you know, if you suddenly discover that it wasn't, you might think, oh, well, never mind. But I don't think, you know, you'd say, well, that car shouldn't be here. I think you'd still want it to be on the grid because maybe it's unique or maybe it just looks fabulous. You know, I think that's probably what counts for more.
I'm not creative or witty enough to find a segue between Van Wall and the new Golf GTI. Are you? Anything spring to mind?
Well, front engine, four cylinders,
number of wheels.
Twin overhead camshafts, four wheels, steering wheel, three pedals, manual gearbox.
The basics.
Yeah.
Okay. So you reviewed it on Drive Nation, at Drive Nation _ on Instagram, everybody. Go and have a look. You reviewed it on Drive Nation on Friday, the day we're recording this, actually.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that leapt out at me from your review is the 7 out of 10 rating.
Yeah. It was actually one of the easiest. Sometimes I agonise over the ratings, and sometimes they just leap out at you, and that to me is an absolute 7 out of 10 car. Now, you know, I should say for anybody who's not completely au fait with the way that we do things at DN that we always mark cars harder than anybody else does. You know, in our entire, whatever it is, 2 and a bit year history, we've only ever given one 10 out of 10. We've done none this year, and I'm completely comfortable with that. So, you know, the point being is that if it's the best car in the class, it's a 9. For it to be a 10, it needs to be genuinely game-changing, as the Alpine A110 was. So, you know, so maybe 7 from me is an 8 from anybody else. But even so, you know, I always really look forward to a new Golf. I mean, ever since whatever it was, 2004 on the Golf 5, when it really rediscovered its mojo, having gone through a terrible period with the 3 and the 4. You know, every new successive Golf GTI has always been something to smile about. And this one, it's not a bad car by any stretch. And I think the rating reflects that. You know, it's pretty good. And I'm sure that most people have and will be pretty happy with it. But it just wasn't what I expected. You know, it's like the 911, isn't it? You know, if you get in a 992, haven't gotten a 991, you know that it's basically going to be that, but better. But they're not going to change the formula. They might cook it a bit better. They might, you know, add a little bit in here, a little bit there. But ultimately, it's the car they would always have made if they'd known how to make it at the time. And this Golf, actually, it does vary the formula. And I think what they've tried to do is, you know, jazz it up a bit. They've tried to make it a bit, well, I know they have. They've made it more sporting. So it's quite a lot stiffer than it used to be. And that means the ride is not, you know, that lovely effortless way that Golf GTIs always, you know, have always ridden. Well, that's sort of been slightly compromised. It's got slightly strange steering too. You're not as sure where the nose of the car is as you'd like, or indeed as, you know, you might find in something like a Focus ST or a Civic Type R. It's just a kind of slightly betwixt and between. It's decided it wants to be more like them and less like itself. And for the car that defined, you know, that entire genre and is still the reference point, for it to sort of not feel comfortable in those shoes and try to do something else, I think is a shame, because, you know, there are no shortage of cars like the Focus ST, like the Civic Type R, which are really, really cool, you know, hard driving hot hatchbacks. And then there's always been the Golf, which has always been, you know, the car, you know, to use the cliche that, you know, it's even better to live with than it is to drive, and it's the car that's quite uncomfortable and isn't in your face when the conditions aren't right. And that's what I've always loved about those cars. I've always sort of felt that in a Golf GTI there's nothing you can't do which is, you know, not right for the car, whether it's, I don't know, going to some posh hotel or sitting in heavy traffic or blasting down a great road. And yeah, it's, I just wish they'd left it like it was. There you go.
Mm. Ah, okay. Well, you could have reviewed that car in 6 or 7 words then. We could distill the essence of DN even down even further, couldn't we? We normally write about 350 words in a review. Let's start doing it in 8. Why not? You're right about the Golf GTI thing, because the whole point about a Golf GTI is that it's like a Golf GTI, and you know what to expect, you know what you're getting, and it doesn't matter that it's not quite like other cars in the class. I haven't driven it yet, but it does seem like a pity that that's been eroded slightly. But the background to this is that generally the Mark 8 Golf doesn't move the game on from the Mark 7 much at all, if anything, does it?
No, not much, no. No, I mean, I think I reviewed that as well, didn't I? It didn't for me. You know, you don't expect revolutions from Golfs, do you? You know, you don't get into a new Golf and expect, you know, all the parameters to be reset, because frankly, they very rarely need to be. It's just what I was saying about the GTI. It applies to the standard car equally. You just want it to be, a steady progression on from where it was. You don't want it to change direction, because the direction that those cars have always gone in has always been, you know, out there in the real world where every road isn't a deserted mountain road. It's always worked so well. And I'm just curious and slightly baffled as to why they have decided that's, you know, I mean, it's not like they've done a volt fast and have been running back in the other direction, but they've deflected slightly. And I don't really understand why that is. It's almost like this is kind of like the performance model. It's the slightly hardcore model, and the cooking car, the sort of standard car, the car that's, you know, frankly, that we probably all want it to be, is coming along in a minute. But I don't think it is. I mean, they've talked about the Club Sport version, and I'm sure there'll be another R. I think this is it. You know, the car I drove was an absolutely bog standard Golf GTI, you know, 5-door manual gearbox. You know, very straightforward. And it was, yeah, it just wasn't quite what I'd hoped. I mean, good car still. And I wouldn't say to anyone, oh, don't buy one of those. But just go into it with your eyes open. That's all.
Interesting. There's another hot hatch that you've been driving recently that I'm desperate for us to talk about, but I don't think we're allowed to just yet, are we?
No, we're not. I get into so much trouble. I'm not even sure they know I've driven it. So trap shut. Oh, okay.
Right. Okay. We'll revisit that one when we're allowed to. All right. Indeed. Well, we're supposed to be talking about Lamborghini, so let's get onto that now. little bit of background then, let's give this some context. So, founded by Ferruccio Lamborghini in 1963, essentially to compete with Ferrari.
Correct.
So there's an interesting story that I've dug out from those very early years, actually from before the company was founded. This is just one account of that story, and who knows how accurate it is, and there might be little falsehoods all over the place, but I just want to run through it quite quickly because it's amusing. So the story goes that Ferruccio Lamborghini commissioned an Italian engineering firm to design his V12 engine for him. To use in his new cars, which he hadn't released to the world yet, but they were coming. And Lamborghini wanted a V12 with similar displacement to the glorious Ferrari V12, the Colombo V12, the 3-litre. But he wanted it to be a road-biased engine rather than a highly strung race engine, which the Ferrari engine perhaps was more so. And the engineer that Lamborghini commissioned was Giotto Bizzarrini, who had a hand, was involved in designing that Colombo V12. And so the outcome was another highly strung engine, similar to the Ferrari one, which wasn't what Lamborghini had asked for. The figure quoted here is that it revved to 9,800, but I'm having a hard time believing that. I think that's just bobbins. It would be good if it did, but that must be nonsense. And so Lamborghini was so displeased with the high-revving, dry-sump engine, which was, in his view, like a racing engine, that he refused to pay the engineering firm. And the engineering firm refused to make it more, in quotations here, well-mannered. And so there was a standoff. It went to court. And Lamborghini was ordered to compensate the engineering firm by the court, so he had to cough up. And the irony being that Lamborghini continues to use a version of that engine until 2010.
Blimey, there you go. I thought I knew a bit about this stuff. I've never heard that story.
Well, we'll just have to hope it's from a reliable source.
I am sure that that most of that is absolutely as was. It certainly sounds entirely plausible, apart from perhaps the 9,800 RPM bit. I know that Bizzarrini was certainly involved at Ferrari in the early 60s, and he certainly had a big hand in things like the 250 GTO, and certainly that V12 is certainly his, in terms of engines, his kind of masterpiece. So I've not heard the story before, but the bones of it has the ring of truth to me.
So the very first Lamborghini road car was
the 350 GT, I think.
Good work. 1964 in production, I think, and 118 were built with a couple of other variants as well, literally two of them, the GTS and two others as well. And then that was followed up by the 400 GT, which only a handful, relatively speaking, were built. Do you have any experience of those very early pre-Miura Lamborghinis at all?
None whatever. There you go. I couldn't tell you a thing. Well, I know what they look. I know they're not very attractive cars, but I know that they are. I mean, I think they're quite respected. I think they're kind of those in the know think they're actually pretty good things. But I've never driven one. So
they've got a kind of frog eye sprite thing going on with their headlights.
They're not very elegant cars. My Lamborghini knowledge, I've driven a few of the early cars, but not that many, because there were just so few of these things built. If today you decided that you wanted to go and drive, I don't know, a Lamborghini Islero, well, they made 125 in total, and goodness knows how many of those are still around, or something like a Harama. I don't know how many of those they built, but it wouldn't have been 500. And these are kind of names that have, we all kind of know the names, but I don't think many people realise just how scarce these cars are. So it's not like, you know, trying to go and drive a Ferrari Daytona or something like that, of which there were, you know, thousands made. These cars are really, really rare. So my Lamborghini knowledge as far as the driving concerned, and even then, not much of it, starts with a Miura.
1966.
Very good.
Now, I love these claims because someone will always pop up and say, I think you'll find. But the Miura is recognised. It's thought to, or said to be, isn't it, the first mid-engine supercar. Does that stand up for you?
Something is ringing in my head. This, ladies and gentlemen, is how you know we don't rehearse these podcasts, because if we had, I'd have gone and looked it up. Oh, I've got a funny feeling it's not, you know, I've got a funny feeling there was something else. And it might even come to Mangusta. There you go. The Tommaso Mangusta. Now, just while you're there, well, I don't know, I may be wrong. So I'm live.
Shall I fill?
Going to look this up. Yeah, could you just fill for a second while I look it up? Hang on.
Okay, Miura 66 to 72, 275 P400s, 338 P400S, 150 P400SV, and then a Roadster and a Yota as well.
Okay, I was almost right. I was so nearly right. It's not the Mangusta, it's the Vallelunga. Okay, so it's the car. Okay, the Mangusta succeeded in 1967, the Vallelunga, which came out in 1964 and was indeed the first mid-engine road car. So there you go. It wasn't the Miura. So, I mean, can I get a Golf GTI like 7 out of 10 for that?
Yeah, that's impressive, actually. You knew it was something, didn't you? But yeah,
I knew it was a De Tomaso. So, I mean, that's kind of okay. And the Vallelunga is properly esoteric. They made, not that I've got Wikipedia in front of me or anything, but they made 58 of them. So, pretty thing. It wasn't. But, you know, in the same way that, you know, the Range Rover wasn't the first luxury off-roader.
Yeah, Golf GTI.
The Land Rover wasn't the first. Yeah, all of that. It's like the jet aircraft, isn't it? You know, everybody thinks of the Boeing 707 as the aircraft that brought, you know, jet aviation to the world, where in fact it was the de Havilland Comet. You know, you get one at the beginning which sort of makes all the mistakes. And then, you know, others kind of look on and think, oh, okay, yeah, I think we can do that now. And then they come and smash it out of the park, and that's when you get your Range Rovers and your Miuras and, you know, and so on and so forth. So it wasn't the first, I think it was the first, and maybe to date, the only car to have a transverse 12-cylinder engine in it.
Oh.
Leave a comment if you think we're wrong. I can't think of another.
That just doesn't seem very clever.
Maybe not. I mean, can you imagine what getting at the plugs on the wrong side are going to be like?
Yeah, toes and pain.
I presume you have to take the engine out to change them. But that's what I thought you were going to say.
Have you driven a Miura?
Beautiful car. I have.
Go on. Which one was it? Which variant?
It was an S. It was an S. Mm-hmm. So it was the one in the middle.
That's the commonest filth one, by the way.
Do they make more S's than Miuras?
I think so. Yeah. Well, if the P400 is the standard Miura, then
yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
275 versus 338. There you go.
Okay. Well, there you go. They made very few of those as well, didn't they? And I must be completely straightforward. I didn't drive it very far, and I didn't drive it very fast. I drove it far and fast enough, however, to think it was a bucket of bolts.
Oh.
The problem with these cars is you never quite know what you're getting in the. So, I mean, I remember this with the first Daytona I drove, which was years ago. I got out of it and I just thought, I can't see what all the fuss is about. It was just heavy, ponderous, cumbersome, didn't feel that quick, looked good. And then I drove one about 2 years ago for a job for Enzo magazine, and it was just like, oh, now I get it, because this was a car that had been properly maintained, properly looked after, and went as it should always have gone, where clearly the first car I drove was a bit of a mutt. And maybe with the Miura I drove, that's the same. But their reputation is certainly not as one of the great driving machines. Beautiful to look at. I mean, you know, some people
stunning.
Will say it's the most beautiful of all supercars, and arguments to this day rage over who actually designed it. whether it was, you know, it was definitely done by Bertoni, but whether it was done by Giorgetto Giugiaro or Marcello Gandini is, you know, is, well, it's a debate to be had, certainly. But yeah, I mean, I've never heard anyone say that a standard Miura or an S are like paragons of driving virtue. I've never read anyone say anywhere that they're incredible things to drive. I think the later cars, the SV, which is the one without the eyelashes, so its looks were slightly spoiled. I think an SV, not that I've even sat in one, but from my understanding is that SVs were a lot better. I mean, clearly they were more powerful, but I think they had sorted out, excuse me, a lot of their problems. And the SVJ, the Jota, was apparently something else again. But yeah, I couldn't say myself, I'm afraid.
Okay, so I do want to talk about the Countach and Diablo and, you know, the more familiar stuff, but I want to quiz you on some of the more esoteric stuff, particularly the 70s.
I'm going to be so disappointing, but go on, try.
And the Yalpa through the 80s. What of the lesser known, which of the lesser known Lambos sort of leap out at you?
Which of the lesser known, okay, the Espada is the one. The Espada, oh goodness, I'd love an Espada. I think our friend Harry Metcalf has one, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
This was the, you know, the 2+2 car that was made. I think it was made for about a decade. From the late 1960s, and it just looks amazing. I mean, in many ways, to me, an Espada is a more striking car than either. I mean, you know, a Miura is, you know, very beautiful and sinuous and voluptuous, and a Countach is kind of a smack in your face. But actually, given it's a 2+2, it's kind of the family car. I mean, you know, these days, if a company like Lamborghini decides to build a family car, you get an Urus. Back then, you got an Espada. And I invite anybody to go look at a photograph of an Espada and a Urus and tell me that the progress has been in the right direction. You know, it's just stunningly beautiful, exquisitely detailed, and I understand, lovely to drive. So that's a kind of standout car for me. The Iraco was, again, not driven one, but by reputation, you know, nice car, but not as good as a 308. Do you remember the Silhouette? I mean, I think that was the kind of bridge between the Iraco and the Jalpa. It was kind of their little car, and I always thought they looked absolutely amazing. Again, never even sat in one, because, I mean, they made 50-odd, I think. Yeah, I mean, I love the looks of all these cars, as I say, I've not driven many, but for me, the problem with all those cars were... But certainly by reputation and by my admittedly limited experience, they've always been cars that whose visuals have kind of written checks that the cars beneath weren't quite able to cash. And to me, I like a car that's a bit understated. And that's why I've always loved things like Daytonas and even Boxers. I mean, a Ferrari Boxer is quite a flawed car, and it was quite heavily criticised at the time. But it's just understated and beautiful. And, you know, when you look at your car and you think to yourself, I reckon it should drive like this, you get in the car, that's how it drives. Whereas if you look at, we'll get on to the Countach in a minute. I've only driven one of those, but it just wasn't what I was expecting.
So the Countach is an interesting one. Let's get stuck into that now. Because, I mean, it was on in production for a long time, and so it evolved quite a lot over the years. And then, you know, you look at an 80s Wolf of Wall Street spec Countach, by which time it sprouted all sorts of lumps and bumps and wings and, you know, ungainly bumpers and all sorts going on. And it becomes a fairly brutalist-looking car. But an early one, mid-70s Countach, is actually a very simple and plain and strikingly elegant thing, isn't it? That wedge shape.
Yeah, the original LP400 is an absolutely gorgeous car. I was somewhere doing another job quite recently, and the chap who had the car I was going to see had one of them. And he also had a later car. And I just remember just looking at the thing and thinking, that is just... Because I don't think of Countach as being beautiful cars, because... you know, when I think of a Countach, I think of Wolf of Wall Street, or I think of Cannonball Run, or that sort of thing. And you know, as you say, these are all the sort of, you know, the bewinged monstrosities that came afterwards. But you know, if you go look at the original concept, or it was first sort of shown in 71, and you go look at that, and it's such an exquisite piece of work. But then, you know, that was, you know, the start of the 1970s, and by the mid-late 1970s, and certainly going into the 80s, you know, fashions had changed somewhat, and, you know, these things became much more in your face, which, you know, but you know, the reason I was disappointed with it, and I don't actually think I'm being terribly fair to the car here for reasons I'll come on to in a minute, is that, you know, I was a kid who grew up in the 1970s, and so to me, the Countach was... It was the car because, you know, although actually it was never as fast as it was made out to be. It never had as much power as was claimed for it, certainly not in the early days. Because it looked so amazing, and because when I read group tests with Ferrari boxes and Porsche 911 Turbo and Aston Vantages in car magazine in the 1970s, the Countach always won. That was my car. That was the car that was on the wall of my bedroom. It was the car that I kind of venerated, and you know, if you'd asked me in 1978 which car I wanted to drive more than any other in the whole wide world, you know, I would have just said Countach. I mean, like, silly question. I mean, how could it possibly be anything else? And then I drove one.
Which one did you drive?
It was a 500 or a 5000S. So it was the last one before the 48 valve car came out, the Quattro Valvole. And I drove it. I only drove it on an airfield, and it was terrible. and you know, again, you know, this is where, you know, Harry Metcalf will start jumping up and down, because he's got a QV which I've not driven, but I've spoken to him, and I've spoken to guys like Chris Harris who have driven it, who just say it's brilliant, and I completely take their word for it. I suspect because A, it's the QV, and the QV was obviously a vast improvement, but B, also because Harry keeps his in apple pie order, whereas this car I drove was probably a bit of a dog. You can never really tell, because they always look nice, that's the thing. But I mean, some things you can't change. I mean, the driving position was terrible. It was a spectacularly uncomfortable car to drive. Couldn't see out the bloody thing. It put all these things between you and the driving experience you wanted to have. And then I fired it up, and it did sound great. It sounded really, really good. But for me, the killer was, it just wasn't that quick. It just didn't feel fast to me. And that kind of shattered the illusion a bit. I just thought this thing was going to pull my head off, and it just didn't, I'm afraid. But you know, we are seeing it from a different perspective, aren't we? You know, but you know, if I'd been, you know, however old I was when I'd driven it, but in the 1970s, and so I hadn't had all these other cars, I hadn't driven a McLaren F1 by that stage. Maybe I'd have gone into it and thought, wow, this is amazing. Or maybe it was just a duff car. It's very difficult to sell.
Yeah, well, you just need to spend a lifetime driving lots of different examples, don't you? And then,
well, indeed, yeah, yeah, finally.
Okay, so let's quickly mention the Diablo, because as we all know, they're very, very easily crashed. Is that right?
Well, yes, apparently so. I felt very sorry for the bloke. I think that circumstances contrived to fortune wasn't on his side then, but I mean, I've never I've never crashed a Diablo. I technically haven't crashed a Diablo.
Hang on, it's yes or no.
Define crash.
An unintended interface with something immovable.
Okay, unintended interface, certainly. Something immovable, no. So
right, okay.
That it moved. So I was in Italy. It was a Diablo Roadster. It was the thing with Diablos are the four-wheel drive cars, which were the main cars, like the Diablo VT, which I think was the original car. They were actually quite tricky. As I found out when I was trying to do a skid in one of these things trying to do a skid on a public road in a four-wheel drive Diablo. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Well, on this particular occasion, I threw it off the road.
Wow.
And there was the thing I hit was a bit of tape. Because I don't know why, but instead of there being a barrier at the side of the road, someone had just strung some tape along it. So I went through that, so that did no damage. And I found myself in a field, which is a bit of a bank, and I was going down the field quite quickly in this thing. But I guess because it had four-wheel drive, I was able to keep my foot in, drive through the field, up the other side, and back onto the road.
Crikey.
Despite the fact that there was, you know, the car was full of grass and hay, and it was making some terrible noises, and I thought, I've just ripped the underneath off this car. We got the car back on the road, and once we'd sort of hoovered it out and crawled all over it, there wasn't a mark on it.
Wow, good work. So yeah. This was in period, was it a new car?
This was in period, yeah. Is this a good time to mention that I just realised that's not the only Diablo I've crashed? I have actually genuinely crashed a Diablo.
Well so, done. This is why we do this podcast, because you're just reminded of extraordinary things that you've got up to over the years. So go on, tell us about the Diablo that you actually did crash.
Okay, no, I did actually do quite a lot of damage to this Diablo. I've got a funny feeling I might have written about this on DN sometime. So if you know this story, then forgive me. It was one of those stupid days that Autocar used to hold, where you'd hire a runway and see how fast you could drive down it. I think I talked about this in my Farewell to Bruntingthorpe story that we did on the podcast. But anyway, I'll be quick. Diablo SE30, which was quite a trick car, lots of nice bits of carbon on it, lightweight, bit more power. And I am going down Bruntingthorpe's runway at 170 something, maybe 180 something, maybe 180 something, I think. And we're sharing the runway with somebody else. So we have one side of it, whoever the other user is had the other. And they had little traffic cones to mark off one half the runway from the other. But there was a 30-mile-an-hour crosswind, which didn't actually bother the Lamborghini very much, but it certainly bothered one of these traffic cones. And I can remember seeing it lift up, literally lift up off the ground, hovered for a minute, and then shot out right in front of me. Waiting for me. And I can remember looking at my hands and seeing them start an emergency lane change manoeuvre at 3 miles a minute, and then just thinking to myself, that's really not very bright. Hit the bloody cone. So I did. So I hit the cone. And, you know, there was a bit of a bang, but I thought, that's going to be all right. But there was a bloke with the timing gear at the far end of the runway. And I can remember driving up to him and him just looking at the car. His face had just gone completely ashen. And it was only a little cone as well. It wasn't a big thing, but and whatever was meant to be weighting it down had gone, so it didn't even have that ballast in it. But my goodness, it made a mess at the front of the car. Obviously, when you're sitting in it, you can't see because the bonnet slopes so far away. But yeah, and it was all the really expensive carbon bits as well, I seem to remember. But there you go. So I have actually had two unintended interfaces in Diablos.
Having thought it was zero. Excellent. That's brilliant.
Yes. Okay, well, there you go.
There's clearly a lot of scope for us to revisit Lamborghini at some point, and I'm sure we will, because we haven't mentioned the Murcielago, the Gallardo. I think, you know, there are some other sort of one-off and a few-off vehicles that we could talk about as well. But I think I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the current stuff, and I wonder if we can find some common ground on the Aventador SVJ Roadster. I remember you talking about it briefly on this podcast, but I think we're talking about visibility and how important that is to the overall driving experience. And you said that in the Aventador, you felt like you could barely see out, particularly compared to a McLaren 720S, which relatively is like a goldfish bowl. Does that mean you didn't much like that car? Or
no, I did. Actually, I really liked it when I could use it the way it was designed to be driven. So you know, there's no point getting into an SVJ unless you're going to drive it fast. Well, I suppose you might, you know, want to crawl up the King's Road and go and park it outside Harrods if you're that kind of person. You know, and good luck to you. I'm not myself. But, you know, okay, what it is not is a car that is disappointing to drive. It's not like it, you know, it's not very quick or it handles badly. It does all those things really well. But because it's the visibility isn't great, because it's so wide, it's a little bit like what I was talking about earlier with the Countach. It puts these things in the way It gets in the way between you and the driving experience you want to have. Now, if you can go somewhere where there's lots of open space and the road is wide enough and it's quiet enough that these things cease to matter, or certainly cease to matter as much, my goodness, there's a proper driving experience waiting for you. I mean, that engine is absolutely epic. Driving a car like that is always fun. It's always a privilege. And you never get out of it thinking that you're anything other than, you know, a really, really lucky boy. And it may be that, you know, just as I'm getting older, I'm just thinking to myself, I appreciate more, how many times you get to drive these cars every bit as much as how much fun they are when you do drive them. And something like a 720S, it doesn't have that howling, screaming V12 in it. But at the same time, you know, you could drive that car down any, you know, country road and, you know, you're not going to be worried about whether you're going to get clouted by that lorry coming the other way. You're not going to be worried about whether you've seen, you know, anything because you can't see over your shoulder every time you get to a junction here. And so you just relax in it more. You feel more confident in the car. And if you are relaxed and confident in the car, your chances of enjoying it are obviously, you know, commensurately greater. So I know that Lamborghini, they kind of have a look and they kind of have a way of doing things. And, you know, and in many ways, particularly their, devotion to, you know, multi-cylinder normally aspirated engines. I mean, I think, the fact that they've still got a V10 and a V12 without a sign of a turbocharger anywhere, I think is absolutely laudable. I just wish they were a little bit easier to drive. What about you?
Yeah, well, you've described the SVJ exactly how I was going to, actually. So, and
sorry,
the McLaren, the McLaren comparison is an apt one, because drive a modern McLaren, the 720S in particular, and you're at one with the car. You have so much faith and confidence in the steering. It feels light. It actually feels quite compact as well. It deals with a bad road surface beautifully. So, in all those ways, it's a far superior car to the SVJ. However, the SVJ, and it's a car built for one scenario only, to be brilliant in one scenario, and that is deserted and brilliant B road up in North Wales, which is where I drove
it.
Dry weather, and then roof off. You just cannot help but be blown away by the whole driving experience. I got out of it shuddering. I was coursing with adrenaline, and I just, in that moment, I just couldn't criticise it, really, because a supercar, not least a Lamborghini, is supposed to make you feel like that, isn't it? And it just, it left me just absolutely wired. And I thought...
And if you could have gone back down that road the other way in either that again or a 720S, you'd have taken the Lambo, wouldn't you?
Exactly, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just the hit it gave you was unbelievable.
Yeah, I understand that.
And you know, that's what those cars are for. It's the first time I think that I've really loved driving an Aventador, because the rest of the time I found them, as you say, big and bulky and difficult and recalcitrant, and you never feel much confidence in them. But my God, in that SVJ, oh, it was sensational. I'd previously driven an SVJ, albeit a coupe, on ice, with the Lamborghini ice driving experience. Normally these things are on frozen lakes, but this one was up in the Alps, next to a ski resort somewhere in Italy. And it was fantastic. You know, it's one of those like Andros Trophy ice racing courses.
Yeah, of course.
It's similar to that.
Yeah.
And basically what they want to teach you there is the Scandi flick. So one way to set the car up and then flick it back the other way to get it into the corner. And after half a morning of it, you find yourself driving this wild looking V12 supercar on ice like it's a rally car, and it's absolutely brilliant. You know, just doing linking corners with big slides, using all the throttle in first and then in second gear. It was fantastic. So
did you stick it in a snowdrift?
Only at sort of nosed in at very low speed.
Okay, so the answer to my question is yes.
I wasn't humiliated by the incident. Let's just say that. But oh my God, it was such a great thing to get to do. Ice driving just always is, isn't it? I'm sure you've done bits and pieces. It's it's such a brilliant way to get to, you know, fling a car around. So there we go. In whether you're, you know, a nice driving, ice racing track or a deserted open moorland road in Wales, the SVJ is epic. Everywhere else, it can be a bit frustrating and out of its depth, really.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think that's fair enough. Yeah.
Okay, but let's now talk about the Huracan, because it's rarely been my sort of mid-engined supercar of choice, but the Evo rear-wheel drive is a sensational thing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely sensational. It's such an annoying car, really, because you know how good it can be. It's like the R8. You know, the moment they disconnected the front drive shafts on that, you sort of, oh, okay, yeah, this is what it could have been all along. And I wasn't quite as down on the Huracan as I think most of my colleagues were when it first came out, but I was very aware of its limitations. But then the Performante came out, and that was really pretty good. I did like that. I thought, okay, this is a proper car. And then the rear drive Evo came out, because the standard Evo, the four wheel drive car, I drove that and thought, oh, well, they messed it up again. But then the rear drive came out, and I mean, I would say that's the best Lamborghini I've driven. And I'm about to go and have another good go in one. And I'm genuinely very excited about it, in a way that I'm not normally about Lamborghinis, because I always have my, you know, I don't let myself get too, you know, wound up about them, because so many times I've got excited and they've just been disappointing. But I've driven this before and I know how good it's going to be, so I can't wait.
Yeah, the thing about the Huracan for me, with the exception of the Performante, is that it's always looked incredible and had that wild V10. But those things were never quite enough to swing it over the comparable Ferrari or McLaren, because the driving experience was just flawed. And it felt sort of held back, didn't it? Like they'd built too much safety into it or whatever.
They understeered. They were difficult to balance on the limit. They didn't steer as incisively. And it's all because of that, you know, that four-wheel drive system, which, you know, for some reason they continue to, I mean, I don't know whether it's because some people, clearly they need to sell them in, you know, sort of snow states in America and places like that. So I guess there is a place for it. And if you like the, if you're an addict to the numbers, you'll get 0.3 off your 0-60 time and, you know, so on and so on. But if you actually just like driving, you just don't need it. I mean, the four-wheel drive takes away so much more than it brings. And, you know, it can literally, in the case of the Huracan, you know, turn a car from one that you can walk away from without a look over your shoulder to one in which, you know, you don't get out of the car at the end of the ride. You're just sitting in it and listening to it and just going back over the drive and thinking, wow, that was something. That was a proper drive. And it is amazing the difference that it makes. And they're cheaper.
Yes. Yes. So you no longer have to overlook a frustrating driving experience to have that V10. And it's a much, much more exciting engine than the twin turbo V8s that you get in its rivals.
100%.
Yeah, that's the key point, isn't it? You now get the driving experience to suit. Okay, well, we do have to wrap this one up, but clearly there's so much more Lamborghini ground that we can cover. I'm sure we'll come back to it at some point.
I can't believe we haven't talked about the Murcielago, which is probably... I think I've just said the Huracan Evo rear drive thing is my favourite Lamborghini, but a Murcielago, or is it Murcielago? I always used to get criticised because I always used to pronounce it wrong. But they're epic things. They were the first of the sort of Audi cars, but they were basically they were Audi-fied Diablos. So basically they were Diablos with all the rubbish taken out and a bit of, you know, Audi nous put in, but we're still, you know, the Lamborghini charm retained. They were epic things. So yeah, I really want to come back and do that justice to that.
Yeah, we will. No question.
And we haven't talked about the SUV either. Or maybe we just decided not to talk about the SUV because
which one do you mean?
Podcast. Who needs to be talking about? Oh well, which one do I mean? I mean the current one, not the. I'm not sure I even want to talk about the LM002 that much. But
okay,
yeah, another time.
Fine. Lots more Lamborghini stuff to talk about, and we will do. So, it just leaves me to say thank you, everybody, for listening. Subscribe to the podcast, please. Rate it. Leave a little review. And if you're minded to, please also check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/DriveNation. And as ever, thank you to everyone who has supported us there already. It makes a huge difference, and it means a lot to both of us. Thank you.
Definitely.
And we'll be back to talk to you all again next week.
Yeah. Thanks so much. All the best.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.